KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akkwan. The Tliné Di have stewarded this area for thousands of years. The tidelands where our studios sit are now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots, but they were once a source of food, a place to maintain smokehouses, and a place to gather driftwood for fuel. In sharing this history, KTOO hopes to honor the ancestors and the descendants of the Akkwan. We realize those families who have never relinquished their ownership and stewardship of their land and waterways and continue to cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront for today and for future generations. We'd also like to take a moment to say thank you to the individuals who helped us craft our daily land acknowledgement. Gnoschich to Vera Starboard, who planted the idea of making it super place specific and guided us on pronunciation. Lillian Petershore, who created so much of the beautiful structure. Ishmael Hope, who gave additional ideas, and Ernestine Hayes, Bob Sam, and Fran Houston, who gave important feedback. We are grateful to all those offering guidance as we grow as an organization. This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Our next guest follows the labor market in Alaska, and one of her specialties is tracking the salaries of women, which continue to lag behind those of her male counterparts. The question of why has been analyzed by some of the greatest minds of our time.
Generations of Americans, and since children are our future, according to the song anyway, I thought it would be a good idea to get their take on it. So we went out on the street, we asked kids to explain why they think women get paid less than men, and this is what they had to say.
Why do you think women get paid less than men for the same jobs?
Girls don't work as hard as the boys.
What are they doing instead of working hard?
Doing other stuff.
Like what kind of other stuff?
Texting and running on the track.
Why do you think that women get paid less than men?
Maybe women aren't acting as they should. Maybe they're acting weird, so people think that they shouldn't be treated as fairly as men would be.
How come the women make less money than men?
Because probably some women in California don't really have jobs.
Why do you think that women make less money than men?
I think because they're very underrated, because they can do more, but people expect them to do less.
What kind of more can they do?
Well, a lot of people underestimate them, and they could do so much more. There's jobs that men can't do that women can.
Like what?
Like, they can be an actress if they want.
And a man can't be an actress.
Well, they can do whatever their heart tells them to do.
How come the woman gets paid less?
I think that's a good place to stop it. Karina, welcome, and thank you for providing that comedy clip. I know the wage gap is no laughing matter, but I think the point of that is the fact that it's even a thing is laughable, right?
Absolutely. And I appreciate Jimmy Kimmel and other comedians for taking a stab at it, because as we know, comedy is kind of one of those things that can take a subject that's very serious and even problematic and make it accessible. You know, the first thing that we need to do is to be able to look at something, and sometimes the way to look at it is to start by laughing. So thank you guys. Thank you, comedians, for your service.
Well, all jokes aside, the gender wage gap is at the heart of what you study for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Would you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. My name is Karina Wiebold, and I'm an economist with the Department of Labor. I have been with the research and analysis section for 10 years now. And one of the primary things that I do now is study Alaska's labor market. So I pay attention to jobs and wages, both for the state as a whole, particular industries, looking at occupations. But in this case, I spent a fair amount of time looking at the difference between men and women's wages and occupational selections.
Right. And you wrote about that in an article for Trends Magazine. Can you tell us a little bit about Trends Magazine, where we might be able to find a copy or read it online?
Trends is, the full name is Alaska Economic Trends, and that is our monthly magazine. It's put out by the Research and Analysis section of the Department of Labor, and it is available both in hard copy if you sign up, and I think there's a small subscription to pay for that, or you can receive it electronically on a monthly basis, or you could just go to our website, which is laborstats.alaska.gov. And the trends page is right there on the front. So go ahead and look at it there.
Your most recent article in Trends Magazine is titled The Gender Wage Gap in 2019. And it made me pretty mad when I read it. Was that the intended effect?
The intended effect was never to incite people to anger, but maybe more to thoughtfulness.
So to be clear, it wasn't because of the writing. It was the data that was presented. Women here in Alaska making only 72 cents on the dollar compared to our male counterparts. And it's actually considered an improvement, right?
It is. And that's a really solid point. We actually started, when we started looking at this data kind of back in the 90s, women were making something closer to 62 cents on the dollar. And that hasn't really increased a whole lot over the last couple of decades. In fact, you know, we had some slight improvements, and then it kind of stayed at 65% to 68% throughout the mid-2000s. So this recent jump to 72 cents on the dollar is actually a pretty good improvement over where we've been historically, and a fairly recent change.
Now, in your article, you've sliced and diced the data in all kinds of ways, by industry, by region, by age, by education. What are you looking for when you break it down like that?
I think that because we know that there is a wage gap in general, macroscopically at the biggest picture, what we are looking for when we slice and dice is exceptions to that wage gap, places where maybe women are not making less than men or the representation is more equal. So that's definitely something we're looking for there. The other thing that we're looking for as we play with the data is teasing out reasons why there might be a gender wage gap. A lot of the sociological reasons behind men and women's wages having a bit of a difference is outside of the scope of this article, though. There's been a lot of other national sociological studies that look at reasons why that might be. We have everything from education, experience, time on the job, occupational selection, and historic and current sexism are all components of the wage gap. So there's a lot to test out there. But what we're trying to do as we look at this wage gap for Alaska specifically and from such a variety of lenses is to get a sense of how pervasive that wage gap is, and also to get information out to folks who might not believe that this is something that we're still grappling with, and let them know that it truly is, and it doesn't matter so much how you look at it, what level you look at it. It's very pervasive.
So is it fair to say that women like you and me working here in Alaska, you in state government and me in, I guess, what's kind of considered the other category of the pie chart, but both of us in the prime of our careers and our main money-making years, we're both making less than men who hold similar or the exact same jobs? Or is that an oversimplification?
It's a bit of an oversimplification. When you take everybody and can start to aggregate it, that's when we start to see the data results. But when you like use me for an example, I work for state government, and state government and local and federal government too has really structured salary ranges and a way to work through those. And so they've really done a lot to eliminate the wage gap by having such structured wages that are pretty much applicable regardless of your gender. So in that way, no, I would be paid on paper the same as a male counterpart for sure. But what we need to do, particularly for like my case, is to step back a little bit and say, okay, I'm being paid the same as a man in exactly the same role. But within our organization, why are there so many more men than women? And even more specifically, in my group, I'm part of the management team. There are four of us, and I'm the only woman. That's a fairly low representation, considering that women are nearly 50% of our overall workforce.
What does your research tell us about the big picture of the state economy?
Well, it tells us a couple of things. One of the things that's very interesting about this recent research is what we talked about just a minute ago when we said that the 72 cents on a dollar is actually a pretty big improvement. So what happened there is that we had the state recession in these times in between, from 2015 to 2018. And COVID's been so big on everybody's horizon that it's hard to sometimes to think back a little bit farther. But our recession cost nearly 11,000 Alaskans to lose a job between 2015 and 18. And two-thirds of those Alaskans were men. And those men were predominantly working in industries that pay men well. So oil and gas, construction, and what we call professional and business services. And at the exact same time, women were working more in healthcare and in public education, and those are two industries that did just fine through that period. Particularly, healthcare continued to grow, and women make up 75% of healthcare workers. So when we look at this question of how are men and women doing and what is the gender differences, we do get a feel for what's happening slightly below the surface in the overall Alaskan economy. We can see that in the recession, men lost employment at a higher rate than women did. And women, as a result, started to look like they're getting a little bit more ahead. But can you really consider that women are ahead if really the only reason they're ahead is because men took a step back? That's not exactly progress for everyone. And, you know, when we look at the wages that women are making, the fact that they aren't making equal wages to men is an opportunity for the state to extract more value from women workers. They could be doing more and they should be paid more. And as a result, the Alaskan economy would be more diverse and stronger. When, you know, there's a good saying that a rising tide raises all ships, and that would be the case. If women are earning more, it doesn't have to come at men's expense, but it could very definitely make the economy stronger and more stable overall.
Hmm. Well, you may have already answered my next question, but I wanted to ask, what would you hope that readers would take away from your article? Is there any call to action?
Well, the biggest thing that I would hope for readers to take from this article is information, you know, really to be able to see, identify, and talk about the fact that this wage gap is systemic and pervasive. We're seeing it everywhere at like every level of education, as you alluded to before, every age group, every industry, every area of the state when we break them into regions. The only place where there's some exceptions to men earning more is in occupations. And out of over 800 occupations that we looked at, men were earning more than women in 80% of them. So you really have to get down to some kind of micro levels before you start to see some exceptions. So what I would be hoping for is for people to take this information, look at it, and apply it to their own lives. You know, talk to your organization about men and women's wages and whether or not there's a salary structure in place that does anything to kind of like, think of a good word for this, but basically something to make sure that the wages aren't based off of more arbitrary things like salary negotiation, which is a place where women generally kind of fall off. Is they are not as aggressive about asking for promotions or initial salary negotiations. And so as a result of that, longer term, they end up seeing their overall total wages falling as a result. So going back to the main question, what would I hope for people to do with this? I really hope that they take this information, think about it, apply it to their businesses and their lives. Ask more questions, talk about salary more freely, talk about the fact that we truly do have this wage gap, and it's not something that like militant feminists made up. This is something that we truly as a society are working with, and that it's advantageous for all of us to find a place where workers are treated equally.
The pay gap exists. It is a thing, and you have the data to prove it. Is there, if you look at things like policy, state legislation, is there any room for improvement there?
You know, there's a number of advocacy groups, such as the Forica Group and YMCA up in Anchorage, that have been working more with organizations, with other businesses, to address the pay gap on kind of a grassroots level. There's always room both for the legislature and for private businesses to take steps forward. Even just public declarations that the wage gap isn't appropriate is movement forward. But I do believe that Alaska actually has a law that says that you can't discriminate on the basis of sex for wages. So, you know, we are taking concrete steps to address that as a state. But part of the issue here is that the wage gap is not simply a result of people deliberately discriminating against women. It's really so much more complicated than that, and we need to take a more nuanced view of it if we're going to look at long-term solving these issues. Issues of like occupational selection and the fact that 75% of registered nurses are women, but they make less than men. What are those men doing as registered nurses that makes them more valuable? Are they doing something, or are they being paid more for a different reason? You know, another question there is, why are only 2% of construction workers women. That's, you know, that's a selection issue. Why don't women want to work in construction? Are there reasons outside of just predilection that are driving those occupational selection choices?
Ooh, that could send us off in a whole different direction, Karina. That could be a whole other interview. But speaking of that, what will you be writing next? Where do you go from here with your research?
Well, actually, the next thing that I'm working on is a little bit different from this. I'm going to be working, publishing an article looking at seafood processing through the pandemic and how they have fared with some of the different constraints on that industry since COVID hit and early to 2020. But specific to the gender, I've done a number of studies in the last couple of years that are really interesting that I think people could look back to. One was published in the spring where we took a good look at that recessionary period from 2015 to 2018 and really test out what men and women were doing and how they were affected differently by those job losses that I alluded to earlier. And a couple years before that, I took a good look at occupations and wages by educational requirements. So looking at jobs that don't require any education past a GED, what occupations are those or a diploma? What occupations are there and how are they being compensated and who's holding those jobs? The ones that are less than a GED or a high school diploma are interesting because in Alaska, that includes a range of retail workers, but it also includes a handful of oil and gas occupations where they're being paid more than 100 grand a year with very low education requirements. So that's another one that we took a look at. Maybe 4 or 5, 6 years ago, one of my coworkers wrote an article about non-traditional roles for men and women and how much historically we've been changing that. So think about jobs that are historically female or male dominated and over the last couple of decades have kind of translated into a more diverse workforce. So we actually have a lot of good research out there. I'm not sure what the next step is going to be for diving into this, but I'm probably going to try to take more controls and what I mean by that is control the data for some other caveats and start to say, okay, well, what if we only look at people who have been in their current position for 2 or 3 years? What if we only look at people who graduated from the UA system after 2000? What are they doing in Alaska? That kind of a thing, so that we can start to look at lower levels of this. And again, try to get to where does that wage gap start to narrow or disappear?
Interesting stuff. Karina Wiebold from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, thank you so much for talking to us about your article in Trends Magazine, available around town and online at labor.alaska.gov/trends. Anything else before we say goodbye today, Karina?
I appreciate your time. I hope that we get to come back and talk about some of our trends articles in the future. And I would encourage folks, women in particular, look at this data, get a little fired up, but don't just get angry, you know, talk about it, think about it, do something about it, work within your own organizations and try and take this data somewhere.
Thank you so much. Great words, Karina. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
Honey, I work so hard for my money and I leave my babies at home.
UAS's Evening at Egan continues with a lecture this week about tribal sovereignty and the interrelationships between tribes. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with 7 cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. Most Alaskans don't understand how much heavy lifting tribal governments do when it comes to serving their members and the communities they live in. But President Richard Chatlyish Peterson hopes to change that. Welcome, President Peterson. Yake, excuse me. Yake iwasatini wasaiati.
Good afternoon, Shelley. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Akta yake gunachish. Would you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, my Tlingit name is Chatlyish. I'm Kagwantan from the Eagle's Nest House. My English name is Richard Peterson, and I'm the president of Tlingit and Haida.
And you are giving a talk this Friday for the Evening at Egan lecture series. It's titled Interrelationships Between Tribes, Corporations, and City, State, and Federal Governments. For starters, what are some of the reasons that you wanted to give a presentation on this topic?
Well, you know, one, I appreciate the opportunity and the platform that the university provides with these evenings at the Egan. And through COVID, you know, we're doing it by Zoom. It's just a really good opportunity to help explain these relationships and how important they are and educate people who may not otherwise know what the tribal governments are, what we stand for, our role is. You know, I always kind of reflect that when I came to Juneau as president of Tlingit and Haida, I actually had talked to longtime Juneauites, and some of them really had no clue the role of Tlingit and Haida. Some thought we were like a social club or something, or, you know, really didn't know, and that we're a sovereign government with citizenry, and that we have intricate programs providing services and advocacy, and that we, you know, have our own governance and our tribal courts and so on and so forth.
Yes, and tribal governments are critical to the communities that they serve. However, the relationship between tribal and state governments remains contentious. Why is that? What are some of the reasons for that?
You know, a lot of it, I think it's just misunderstandings. And I think what people don't know and assumptions create pretty big divides. And I think folks think that our sovereignty threatens, you know, other sovereignties. You know, whether that's a municipal or state government. I come from a very small community on Prince of Wales Island, and there's 4 federally recognized tribes on Prince of Wales Island and 9 communities. And, you know, we worked really hard to build relationships with each other as tribal governments, but then also with our communities, our non-native communities and our municipal governments. And I think we demonstrate when we pull together, you know, what is that? Rising tides, we all rise together, you know? And so we're able to prove that. And I think when a tribe is healthy, I've adopted the adage, healthy tribes make healthy communities. And I think that's something that people just don't understand.
I want to follow up on that. You say healthy tribes make healthy communities. What does that look like to you at the ground level?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, at a very basic, it means, you know, we've created economic and social and health opportunities. We have healthy, well-adjusted communities and citizens. You know, the tribes provide quite a few different services. And I think if done right, if we're doing our job right, our citizens reflect that, and they're you know, healthy contributors to the community, to their families, to you know, schools and everything. So, you know, I think that's where we can really demonstrate that.
You had mentioned that misunderstanding is maybe part of the reasons why there is so much contention. What are some of the misunderstandings about governments, such as Central Council, that you come across in your work?
Sure. Well, I think one basic misunderstanding is people think it's about race, and that they don't understand that we're a sovereign nation, that we you know, our governance has existed since time immemorial. And so the federal government and has worked with us to solidify that, you know, and as you know, anybody who knows history knows that hasn't been an easy relationship, but establishing tribal governments and ANCs, and these things have been an opportunity to recognize our own governance, our own leadership, and that, you know, it was never necessarily done away with or replaced. So, you know, we have an important role, and we do important work in advocacy every day.
What do you wish more people understood about tribal sovereignty?
I think recognizing that it, one, puts us on a, you know, we're not like on even keel with even the municipal governments. We're actually above them in the hierarchy and the way that works. But also that, again, I'll repeat that our sovereignty doesn't threaten anybody else's. Having a strong, vibrant tribal government doesn't take away from anybody else. It doesn't mean you get less or that we get more or anything like that. And I think we, again, if we have healthy tribal governments, if you have a local healthy local municipal government, if you have a healthy state government, we all prosper. And I think, you know, if you look across Alaska and many of our rural communities, you know, water and sewer, health clinics, schools, most of them only exist in there because of the tribes and the monies that tribes bring into those communities. I come from a very small rural community, Kasan. When I was very young, we didn't have running water. Running water and electricity was brought in because of Native monies. Well, everybody benefited from them. They didn't just go and provide it only to Native households. It was provided for the whole community because we were a Native community with a tribe.
I think we've seen that demonstrated even more recently with the vaccine rollout and what a huge role that tribal organizations and tribal governments played in making sure that not only their own citizens were vaccinated, but others as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because I've seen some of the kickback on that and people upset. And it's like, we should all be celebrating the fact that those opportunities were there and that we want healthy communities. We all need to play our role in stopping this virus. But it was good to see the recognition, and not just the recognition, I guess, but the rollout by the Native Health Service, right? From Search has done a phenomenal job here in Southeast to Alaska Native Tribal Health and ANMC in Anchorage. You know, I think they've demonstrated that collectively when we pull our wisdom, our money, and our resources together, we have one of the best healthcare systems in the nation here in Alaska. And I think, you know, we can all sit and say, oh man, you know, I can complain about Search all day long. I had a missed appointment, or they canceled it, or did this, or there's some mistake. I can guarantee you, I'm so thankful for the health system that we have. I've literally, they've saved my life. You know, I've been in the rural community. I literally went into anaphylaxis from allergic reaction, and it was those healthcare providers that brought me back and saved me. You know, I'm here today because of our health system. Now, you know, everything can use continual improvement. There's no doubt about that. And as a head of Clinkin Haida, I can tell you we are constantly looking at ourselves for ways to improve because we know we need to do better. You know, the recent Rescue Act distribution, you know, I'm sure there's, if you go on social media, you will see plenty of complaints. You know, we'd made a promise of a 2-week turnaround that was a, you know, we goofed up on that one, and I'll own that. I'll sign my name to the mistake because, you know, it was a mistake. You know, it caught us off guard, and all we can do is to tell you, hey, we're every day endeavoring to do better. We're going to do better tomorrow than we did today.
Well, thanks for sharing all that. And I appreciate your humble attitude and your forward focus. But I wanted to ask your opinion on how state governments can be good or even better neighbors to tribal governments.
Oh, goodness. I can stand on a soapbox all day on this one. You know, I think we have, you know, the misnomer is that we don't have a relationship with the state, and we do. You know, Clinkin Haida, we ourselves, we operate public safety, we operate TANF, and we have, you know, a child welfare compact. But it's ironic to me that they officially don't recognize our sovereignty and that we're here. But any agreement we enter into with them, they ask us to waive our sovereignty, you know. And I think, you know, my own personal success in my field and the work I've done has been based on relationships. And, you know, relationships aren't one-sided. It's a two-way street. I have to respect you at the table just as much as I'm asking you to respect me. And it's really hard fundamentally to do that when they don't even want to acknowledge our sovereignty, our existence, our place here, right? And so, you know, I've been a part of an initiative, Alaskans for a Better Government, and it's with Laganai, Liz Medicine Crow, and Wahlalgadak, Barbara Blake, and I. and we're the co-chairs, and we've partnered, and we've got a ballot initiative that the lieutenant governor just signed off on last week. And it's going to affirm, you know, should it get, we get the signatures and we get it on the ballot and it passes, then it'll affirm that relationship, that we have a government-to-government relationship, that there's that recognition there. And I've had people say, oh, it's really only symbolic. Well, then, you know, so is a marriage certificate, I guess. It's symbolic. You know, the ring you put on your finger is only symbolic. No, it's not just symbolic. I think it affirms that relationship. And I think it's, you know, I've watched for the last couple of sessions where the House has had a bill to recognize Alaska's tribes, and it, you know, hasn't made it through the Senate side. And I, you know, just frustrated at watching that. And we thought, you know what, maybe it's time to take this to our people. And it's, what do the people of Alaska say? Not just our Native people, but what do Alaskans say? Do you recognize tribes? Do you agree when I say healthy tribes make healthy communities? You know, and I think the majority does. There, we did a work with a group that did a poll early this spring that said over 60% of those polled agreed that tribes in Alaska should be recognized. So, you know, that gave us the idea, like, okay, let's do this. And honestly, I really believe in power of the people. So let the people tell our state government. And, you know, I think it's hard to ignore the will of our people.
I think there's some folks out there who might be surprised to learn that while Alaskan tribes and their government, something like 229, are recognized at the federal level, they are not formally recognized at the state level. And that's maybe you can tell me a little bit more about what the proposed ballot initiative means. It, we'd be voting on it in the in next year, if that's correct, and it'll be on the ballot and we can vote on it. And what does it mean if it passes?
Well, again, it affirms that relationship, and I think that it should compel the legislature and our administration that, look, you have these recognized tribes to work with. I think we leave millions of dollars off the table that could come to Alaska, that we could be working together on projects for all of Alaskans. And if we did work together, we would have stronger communities. You know, we are at a state of crisis in not just rural Alaska, but I'd say Alaska in public safety. But, you know, it's paramount in rural Alaska where, you know, you could wait days for a response. We have a very limited VPSO force across rural Alaska. And, you know, their abilities are limited and they're, you know, kind of the best front line right now. But we could do more to improve public safety working with the state and municipal governments. And I think that's what we need to do. And I think, you know, you talk about education. Look, one of the biggest divides in Alaska is the inequity in broadband, right? Mm-hmm. And right now tribes are allowed 2.5 gigahertz in their areas, which is huge. And the federal government just allowed this, and there's billions of dollars coming at us to tribes for broadband. You know, I think of the community of Akiak in Western Alaska. My good friend Mike Williams is the president there. They're putting up towers today. It's their tribe bringing broadband, high-speed internet to our communities. And we see an out-migration in our communities, people leaving because of job opportunities. Well, you know what we learned in with the COVID and this pandemic is we've been hiring people to, you know, all of our people have been working from home. And then it was that aha moment. If our existing staff can work from home, we can hire people and they don't all have to be in Juneau. And so we've been hiring people for jobs that where it can work, that they're be remote. And they're in their villages. But you know what they need? High-speed internet. You could stem the tide right now if we had equity in high-speed internet across Alaska. And you don't even have equity, you know, between neighborhoods. I mean, from one part of Juneau can be really good and another part bad. Same for Anchorage or anywhere else. So broadband, I think, is kind of the next generation of how we can really bring sovereignty, and I think it's going to be a huge step for Alaskans as we materials online and sell them. You can do online e-commerce, education, health. I mean, we need high-speed internet, you know. And sure, it might be for those that have Netflix or gaming, that might be great too, but I have to believe that it's going to be what really evolves and going to be the next step in kind of the technological evolution of our country.
I could honestly keep talking to you about this all day, but we've kind of got off track. You will be presenting this Friday, and your presentation is again about the interrelationships between tribes, corporations, city, state, and federal governments. It's via Zoom, 7 o'clock, 5 p.m. It's free. You could register at uasalaska.edu. Are these some of the topics you'll be touching on in your presentation?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about is, you know, the existing relationships, where they are, where they've been, and where they should be.
That's great. I hope everyone tunes in. I personally have a lot of questions I didn't get to ask you today, so maybe I'll save those for Friday. And I'm just, you know, really interested in hearing about some of your experiences and your opinions. Richard Chatley-Ish Peterson, President for Central Council Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. Thanks again so much for talking with me today. Gunash Chish.
Chish, how are you?
This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Fall means fun, and if fun is what you have in mind, you might want to put this one on your calendar for Saturday, Christ Lutheran Church's Fall Harvest Festival. So joining us now to tell us about the event, Midgey Moore, who is a church member as well as an event organizer. Hi, Midgey.
Hi. Good to be here.
And Cale Mead, pastor for Christ Lutheran Church. Welcome, Cale.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here today. So the Fall Harvest Festival is happening Saturday, October 16th from 6 to 8 in the church parking lot. That's at 10300 Glacier Highway. Tell me all about it. First of all, how did the idea come about? Were you just guys just like going nuts in hunker down mode and decided you needed to throw a festival?
I think that was part of it. We have some young families at Christ Lutheran Church, and we're always looking for ways to kind of invite and interact with other young families in the community too. And so we were trying to think of a good way and a safe way for everybody to kind of, enjoy each other's company. And so we've hosted the Fall Harvest Festival before in the past, not last year, obviously. But this will be our first time hosting the whole thing outside. Which comes with its own challenges in Juneau, but a lot of cool opportunities too.
So what's on the program for the Harvest Festival? What are some things that you can expect if you attend?
Well, a couple of the fun things is that we're going to have, we have up above our parking lot in the church parking lot, there's a trail that we've built that is going to be kind of like a fun little spooky I spy kind of trail. And so there's going to be lots of opportunities for kids to just get out and have fun. We're going to have a door prize with a big box donated by Juneau Food Tours, but also some things from the church as well, like blankets and candles and things. And then we'll have hot dogs and chili, water and cider. And then we're going to have a little selfie corner where people can take photos with funny faces and different things. But the big thing is that it's designed for children up to about 10 or 11. They don't need to wear a costume. We're strongly encouraging nothing scary because this is a fun activity, especially for the younger kids. But really a time to just get together and have fun. And because it's going to be outside, we want to make sure that we are still observing all the city mandates and things like that, masks and all of that. But they all get goodie bags and things to take home. And so it's just a great way for the community to come together, and hopefully it won't rain.
Well, I understand there will be festival tents up there out mm-hmm. to help protect participants from rain if that should happen, and a cry room available. It says for parents, mm-hmm. but I have a feeling it's for parents with kiddos.
Exactly. And then we'll have games and activities for the kids, but just a lot of fun things to just make it more of a community event and just get people out and about and looking, something to look forward to.
Are there any structured activities on the event program, or is it all sort of self-guided? I guess self-guided is not the right word, but you know what I mean.
It'll be mostly self-guided. you know, the plan would be when you come into the parking lot, you see the tents and maybe just kind of take things in as they come along. And we're still working out the details of exactly how everything's going to flow. But if you park in our lower parking lot and start there, you'll kind of work through. We'll have games. Maybe that would be the most structured thing, or some kind of interactive game things, and kids can win candy and stuff like that for doing the games. And then you'd work your way up into our upper parking lot, where, like Midgey mentioned, you'd have the little trail that we've kind of worked on. And in there, there'll be sort of like a guided scavenger hunt, or like an I Spy style thing. Some of our event organizers did a really great job of making like shaped cutouts that they've going to outline in string lights, and so the kids can walk through there and be able to, like, oh, there's the pumpkin, there's the bat, or, you know, things like mm-hmm. that, and just kind of make their way through there. When the kids come in, they'll all get in their goodie bag a little flashlight that they can use to kind of help them along on the trail and things like that. So yeah, we wanted people to be able to take it in at their own pace. And, you know, if you've had little ones before, you know that a meltdown could be just around the corner. So instead of locking people into a big program, it was kind of take in what you can. And if you need to use the cry room, even if the adults have to use the cry room for a second, I guess that would all be fine. But just letting people take it in at their own pace.
I think it sounds like so much fun. I imagine as an event organizers, it must have been a pretty good time to kind of put all this together, and especially like get the decorations and the goodie bags and stuff together. Midgey, what was that experience like for you?
Oh, you know what? We have some ladies that at our church that Angie, Erin, and the pastor's wife, Lauren, who are like the super creative people, creating all of these fun decorations and things like that. And being a part of it has been a lot of fun for me. I've been able to help coordinate, of course, food stuff and things like that. And then we have Elizabeth, who's helping coordinate a lot of our PR and just helping us get the word out and things. But it's really been fun to see all of these folks in our church come together and bring their strengths to the table to do something fun and different for our community in a time where we're just chomping at the bit to get together in a safe way and to be able to work together and have fun together and to meet new people and for them to meet us. And it's our little group is just they're doers, and it's so impressive to just be around them.
I know that. I mean, I talk to people every week on this show who have just can't really take it anymore, and they are doing the best they can to coordinate mm-hmm. events and make sure that they are safe because they just need that outlet. Kale, Midgey, do you guys feel like your congregation and anyone else who might come to this event is just ready for that?
We hope so. Definitely in our little corner of the community, our church family has been feeling that somewhat. And like you said, to be able to do things like this again while still being aware, still trying to be safe and conscious of the situation and the climate that's going on. But just like everybody else, still trying to navigate how can we still do things like the Fall Harvest Festival in light of everything that's still going on? And we do believe there is a safe way to still have fun with people like that, especially if you can do it outside.
Well, I'm really glad that you guys have taken all that into consideration, and it looks like you're on track to have a fun and safe Fall Harvest Festival this Saturday. That's the 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. in the Christ Lutheran Church parking lot, 10300 Glacier Highway. Anything else you guys would like to say before we sign off today?
I do just want to reiterate that this is it's not a Halloween theme, it's a harvest theme, but if the kids want to come in costume, they certainly are welcome to. And we just are encouraging not to have scary or gory costumes, because we're going to have a lot of younger children, and it's not to scare them. It's to just embrace the fall and all of the fun things that come along with basically the first holiday of the holiday season and being able to come together for that. And so we just want to make sure that we remember the little kids and we don't want them to be too frightened.
A good reminder. Well, thank you both so much, Midgey and Kale. I hope you have a great time this weekend.
Thank you so much, Shelley. It's always great to see you.
You as well. Take care.
Yep, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.